Welcome to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. I'm your host, Evan Epstein. In this episode, I talk with Derek Zaba, a partner and co-chair of Sidley Austin's shareholder activism practice. Derek counsels companies on a variety of matters, including activism defense, proxy contests, activism preparedness, takeover defenses, shareholder engagement, and corporate governance. Prior to Sidley, Derek was the head of activism defense practice at Camberview Partners. He also served as a partner and investment professional at activist and event-driven hedge funds. Derek began his career as a corporate associate at a New York-based law firm. In this podcast, we talk about the current state of shareholder activism, the most relevant takeaways from the last proxy season, and the rise of ESG in some of these campaigns. We also discuss the current market down cycle, hostile M&A trends, the impact of activism in the tech sector, and the practice of dual-class share structures in founder-controlled companies. Finally, we address the adoption of universal proxy cards and the lessons for directors on how to approach some of these new activism trends. If you'd like the show, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. You can find all the show notes on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com. Derek, it is so good to have you in the Boardroom Governance podcast. We've exchanged a few emails and correspondence, and we're finally here. I know it's a busy time for anyone dealing with shareholder activism, so I'm super happy to have this conversation, and thank you very much for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Evan. I'm glad to be here.
All right. So we usually start with the origin story of our guest. So why don't you tell us where you were born, where you grew up, and we'll go from there to your current practice at Sidley Austin.
Sure. Yeah. I grew up and spent my early life in Chicago, Illinois, and spent the first 18 years of my life there until moving to Washington University in St. Louis, where I graduated with an applied math and a finance MBA. So I was very much an odd duck here in the law firm that I have a very quantitative mindset. Mm-hmm. Those are my roots. And when I left Wash U, I moved to Capital One. And Capital One at the time was at the forefront of using data to make decisions. And so the pitch from Capital One was, well, you could go somewhere else and spend 5 years getting people to trust your judgment before they take your opinion seriously and you make decisions that impact the business, or you'd come here. And if you can put forward a compelling story with the data from day one, you can impact the business. So given my background with the quantitative and the finance, it was a very compelling move to go to Capital One straight out of undergrad.
And that was in 99. So it was in the heady days of the dot-com era, right?
That's exactly right. And that's, I had in the back of my head, I was always going back to law school. And for those of us that were around in 99, Silicon Valley really was the center of the universe and the envy of everyone else on the planet. So when I applied to law school in that time, Stanford was clearly the place that I wanted to go and at the center of the place that was the where everybody wanted to be. So it was a pretty logical choice at the time for me to go to Stanford.
Although, and interestingly, you went just after a crash. It was a good time to go to law school.
You know, it's fascinating because when I went there, I thought I'd stay forever. And I'm currently located here in Silicon Valley, as you know. But by the time, you know, between first year and second year, the entire market had fallen out. And given my background in business, finance, M&A, and especially the contested part of M&A was really interesting and attractive to me as I was going through my second and third years of law school. And so I ended up fairly logically at Wachtell Lipton. Uh-huh. In New York. So I spent a lot of my time at Wachtell and complex, you know, M&A, contested M&A in those types of situations, which is exactly what I was interested in.
And then you left to the finance side. So tell us about your leaving the big law at that stage.
Sure. At that time in 2005 was really the heyday of hedge funds, right? That was the time when money was cheap, or at least we thought it was cheap then, although it was expensive relative to where it is now. There was a lot of LBO, private equity activity, and hedge fund world had exploded. And so I moved over to a hedge fund that invested in situations and companies that were going through issues such as those that I was involved in at Wachtell. So contested M&A, shareholder activism, other corporate events that were significant to the company. So it was called an event-driven hedge fund, and I was an investment professional there, and then moved over from one hedge fund to another and moved back out here to the Bay Area, to where I was a partner at an activist hedge fund. So really all around, and this is the story of my career, I've been really moving seats and moving around the table that is complex M&A and shareholder activism and seeing it from different vantage points. So I moved to a hedge fund where I was a partner at that activist hedge fund.
And from there, you go to PJT Camberview, which is in the defense side and the shareholder advisory side.
That's right. That's right. And they were, you know, PJT Camberview, which was Camberview when I was there before it was acquired by PJT, was really, you know, formed by those people, as you know, that founded and led the governance teams and the proxy voting teams, that the investors that are making all the decisions, the big decisions in when it comes to a vote, BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, Fidelity, all of the big institutions, ISS and Glass Lewis as well. And a lot of them got together to form an advisory firm back in the 2011-2012 timeframe. So that was, having been on the activist side and seeing the power that these institutions wielded in determining the outcomes of votes, it was a logical next step for me to go there and working up to head the activism defense practice at Camberview. And I think that it's still the case, even more so, where these institutions are really driving the outcomes of any vote, including contested situations, but really even more broadly.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting. I don't know, there's many people that have gone from being an activist to on the defense side. They tend to be very strong fences, but you're one of them. That's really interesting. And then you leave Camberview and you go back to Big Law, Sidley Austin.
That's right. That's right. I was able to skip the associate years, the senior associate years, and the junior partner years. So I think I'm the envy of a lot of law firm partners. But yes, ended up back on the legal side at Sidley. And I think Sidley, I mean, it's a terrific platform, and we'll get into it a bit. But I think that the way that we approach these contested situations is just very, very different than other law firms. So it was very attractive, given my background, having seen all of the other players, all of the other seats, having worked with all of the other advisors. Sidley was a logical place, logical next step. So I joined. I joined my partner Kylie Kafet, who founded the practice here. Now we work together along with many others in the practice.
Yeah, tell us more about how is it so different to other law firms, and what makes it so special or distinctive?
Yeah, this is all we do. So we have two partners dedicated full-time 100% to shareholder activism and contested M&A. We have several other partners who spend a material or a majority of their time on shareholder activism. And importantly, we have a team of associates who spends a majority of their time on shareholder activism. So I think many of our associates have seen, you know, dozens of campaigns. Our practice has seen over 100 proxy contests over the last 5 years. And because we are so specialized, and because we've now been doing it for many, many years, there's a virtuous circle aspect to it, right? So we've just seen so much and been involved in so many different situations, that the level of experience and expertise we have is large. And we're brought in, one of the ways that we are a bit different is, you know, sometimes we're brought in to be the law firm to represent the company, and sometimes we're brought in to assist existing corporate counsel, and we act as a SWAT team. We come in, we help them with their problem, and then we move on. And so
what is the percentage of time that you are a law firm versus like the SWAT team?
Well, I think it's a law firm either way. The question is just whether we're partnering with the existing law firm that's there versus coming in and being the one that's really doing everything. Was really what I was trying to convey. But I think we're often brought in situations when it looks like the activist situation is going to get more complicated, where it looks like there's potential for a proxy contest. Then they often look to us to come in and really lead that effort.
Okay. Let's talk about what's going on in the proxy world. And it seems that we have a very active proxy season, 73 campaigns globally this year. But maybe you can give us more of your sense, given your history. Are we in a mode of many campaigns. Is it going up or down? Where are we?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think we're back in the pre-COVID levels, right? I think we've totally cleared the COVID bump or whatever you want to call what happened over the last couple of years. And we're back to the levels of 2018. And I think that's true both in terms of the amount as well as the mix of activism, right? The mix shifted a little bit as we got into COVID. But where it feels just, you know, anecdotally, it feels like it did before we actually, you know, got into COVID. But I think the other piece of it, which is true and is even more true as time goes on, is you look at all of the statistics about campaigns, and those are just the ones that are public. You know, those are the tip of the iceberg, and you're having many more that settle very early, including when the activist has not ever raised their head. And when I say settle, I mean settle broadly. So that doesn't mean just settlement agreements. It means companies take steps in line with what the activist is talking about and is advocating for the company. And many times the company is leaning or thinking about doing those things anyway, taking those actions, and the world never sees an activist ever in the stock. They move on after the company has taken their actions. So I think you're seeing the tip of the iceberg here, and that is more true now, it feels like, at least anecdotally, and I don't have the stats obviously because it's not public, but it feels like that's happening more and more these days, where there's a lot of situations that resolve themselves before they ever reach the public eye.
Yeah, actually, anecdotally, I was watching an interview of Nelson Peltz last night, and he was saying how sometimes they go into companies and tell the company what they think the strategy should be, and there are different types of reactions, and some companies go along and they doesn't need a board seat, and others are more contested. And I suppose what you're saying is there are a lot of cases where the activists go in and buy a portion of the shares and the company goes along. So we don't see those cases, basically.
Yeah, and I think that's easier to do when you have an activist that comes in with some operational or even capital allocation type suggestions. So I think you should, you know, increase leverage a little bit. I think you should take these steps from an operational perspective. I think you should spin off a division, right? I think if these are things the company can get there, a lot of times they're thinking about anyway, and they can get their arms around. Where you see situations that are less prone to settle are situations where the activist comes in and says, you should sell the company now. You need to change the CEO. So these are situations where the company may agree. And if the company agrees, then, you know, then we're moving in the same direction. But if the company disagrees, there really isn't room for a middle ground if those are what your arguments are, the activist. And so those are just you know, practically speaking, much more difficult to settle because there's really not a compromise in those couple of situations. And so we're seeing the situations we are seeing going to fights nowadays tend to be more and more the situations you would logically expect to go to fights, because there really isn't a middle ground in these types of situations.
Yeah. I mean, one of the interesting takeaways from that interview is that he said they never take any issue to the board itself. They never talk in the board. It's always behind either with the CEO, the CFO, or somebody. And, you know, a lot of people may think that this is a type of situation where the board gets involved, but Nelson Peltz was saying, well, it's never in a board level situation.
I'd say that's the exception rather than the rule. And it is true. And when we talk about activists broadly as a class, but they are very different. And there's a whole range of activists, and that's Nelson Peltz's approach. And he's been doing it for a long time, but it's not the typical approach. And every activist has their own way of approaching companies, from trying to collaborate behind the scenes to some activists that are still, you know, doing what they did 15 years ago. And they call the company 15 minutes before they put out a press release and a white paper. Yeah. So you really do see the gamut of how activists approach companies these days.
No, that's fascinating. You mentioned pre-COVID. What happened in COVID? What happened in the activist market and during COVID? Did the market slow down? What exactly, you know, happened in that regard?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, it slowed down for a couple of months, right? It was a very, very quick slowdown. I think when COVID hit, which was in the middle of proxy season or the beginning of proxy season, then this happened. We saw this in the financial crisis as well. You have to remember, activists are mostly hedge funds, and hedge funds, as a general rule, are fragile institutions. And so, when you have a shock like this as a hedge fund, you immediately worry about staying in business, right? That becomes your ultimate priority. And so for the first couple of months, we really saw a scale back in activity. We also had a situation where companies were more focused on keeping their employee base together and not getting COVID and putting in additional protocols. And so you also had a phenomenon where the shareholders in these situations, unless you had a compelling case as an activist, or this had been a campaign going on for multiple years and there was only 3 months left, other than those two situations, shareholders didn't want activist level change at a lot of companies. Even if they thought it was needed as of January 2020, there were other things going on and that could wait. And so you saw a real slowdown for a couple of months. But as we all know, the markets rebounded very, very quickly. Very, very few hedge funds went out of business, unlike in the financial crisis. And you saw it return even into the summer. I remember in July, we started seeing little activists showing up talking about capital allocation and increasing leverage, which was, you know, just way, way, in my view, much too quickly to be talking about these those things, because the companies that had excess cash and the companies that weren't super lean from an inventory and perspective and an operational perspective were the ones that were able to weather COVID much better. Mm-hmm. And very, very quickly, we're returning to the same types of activist arguments that we had before COVID. So it rebounded extremely quickly, just like the markets did.
Yeah. And one trend that I think we have to talk about is that activists and companies continue to favor settlement over drawn out proxy fights. And how do you see this moving forward? Do you think that's going to continue? It does sound like most of the action is in the settlement area.
Yeah, and that's always been the case. I mean, there really are, you know, several hundred companies that are approached by activists in any given year, and the number of actual proxy contests, meaning a nomination notice for directors is delivered, is, you know, 2 dozen, maybe a little bit more. Right. So the vast majority get resolved well before you get to a proxy contest, and that makes sense. Usually, there is a common ground to be able to, you know, settle, and it's in both sides' interest to settle, right? The cost and the distraction and the brain damage of going through a proxy contest isn't in either side's interest, right? So it is a logical outcome is to settle, and it will always be the case. And I think this is one of the areas where I think activists do have an advantage, is that they put forward their thesis, they put forward their arguments, and the company has to respond. And in an ideal world, you'd have a board of directors that thinks about what their current plan is, thinks about what the activist plan is, and makes a decision, an academic decision, kind of on what's best for the company. But the problem is you have activists that are threatening very directly to put costs on the company of going through a contest. And in many cases, they are threatening this will be personal, this will be long, this will be brutal. And so if you're a board of directors thinking about two paths, one of those paths is encumbered with 3 or 4 months of distraction and cost. And you have to remember, I mean, very few of my clients have stock prices that have been up and to the right for the last 5 years, right? These are companies where they have had some sort of hiccup. And so to go through another 3 or 4 months of brain damage and costs and distraction at a time when they really need to be focused on the business is not ideal. And so that's unfortunately the situation that boards of directors are facing when faced with the proxy contest. And that also leads to additional settlements, because just the going through a contest can be so damaging to a company.
I was just reading through the Lazard report, and they're saying that 91% of the total 75 board seats that were awarded were done through settlement, right? So it just shows you that that's where a lot of it is happening. I suppose this is where your counsel is really important, because the company goes, well, what should we do, right? And it's the decision of settling or not. And, you know, what goes into that decision? I mean, you mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of distraction, there's a lot of cost. And is there something that typically, I've heard from some practitioners that companies tend to settle too quickly and don't take a fight. But as a leading practitioner in this area, how do you think about this?
Yeah, I think a couple of things. One is settlement is not a point in time decision, right? You can settle at many different times. And just because an activist shows up, the answer isn't settle or fight. It's settlement right now, and the terms you can get right now, and what the activist is saying right now, is that the right answer? Or do you need to push back and progress a little bit towards a fight. I've heard activists say, use terms like, sometimes you have to show the blade a bit to get what you want, right? You have to threaten a little bit. Well, I think as a company, many times you have to push back a bit before you can get to a point where you have a settlement that you think is in the best interest of the shareholders. And activists, certainly even more and more these days, you're seeing activists threaten more change, threaten more director change, put up more directors than is called for in the situation, just to get leverage in the negotiation. So if you objectively look at a situation and say, well, I think this is a situation, looking at how every other situation has played out, and two independent directors might make sense here with these skill sets, an activist will put forth a slate of six, and they're trying to negotiate three or four as the middle ground, and sometimes including an activist principle. And so you have to be willing to push back a lot of times before you can get to the point where you have a settlement that you think is, you know, the right answer for the company.
It makes me think that it also depends a lot on the stage of the company. So in your practice, how much is it large caps versus mid caps and small caps? And historically, most of the action has been on small caps. So what is your advice depending on those stages of companies?
Yeah, I think it's different, right? I think you hit the nail on the head by market cap or size, right? If you look at the small mid-cap activism, it's different than large mega-cap activism. We used to not be able to have large and mega-cap activism because in the old days, you needed to have a 5% stake and then file a 13D in order to get taken seriously by other investors. And that could never happen at a $200 billion company. Nowadays, if somebody has $1 billion stake and it's 0.2% or 0.5%, these are credible activists. You mentioned Nelson Peltz. There are another dozen activists that are credible enough to go after large and mega caps. So size is not a defense against activism like it was a while ago. But I do think you see a difference you could spend a whole session talking about the difference between large and mega cap activism versus small cap activism. Our practice really ranges the gamut. So mm-hmm. we do a lot of small mid cap and large cap size, as well as the mega cap size. I'd say the proxy contests tend to be in the mid-cap size. That tends to be the sweet spot for proxy contests where our clients are, simply because a lot of the mega caps get settled earlier. It's very rare to have a mega cap go to a proxy contest, mm-hmm. but it really does range the gamut. It's just that the identity of the activists in those two camps is typically very different.
Yeah, and I know you cannot talk about specific cases, but everyone read and heard about the ExxonMobil case where that was exactly what happened. A mega cap company and an activist that had 0.02% of the shares and won a proxy fight, which was unheard of. So what are the lessons? What are the takeaways maybe from that case and in general in the proxy season for you?
Yeah, I think I can't talk about that situation or any other situation specifically, but I do think that it does reflect what I said about size is not a defense. The other thing that it was notable for was the use of the environmental prong of ESG. So we really hadn't seen prior to that somebody do a good job of integrating the environmental or social aspects of a thesis into their campaign. So that has always been the problem with environmental and social issues and activism is they have to be woven into what your economic thesis is. Otherwise, it just looks like a complete non sequitur. So an activist shows up and says, I think you should sell the company and you need to do it now. Oh, by the way, you also need to care about the environment, right? It's just such a disconnect. It looks like pandering to the voters. It really, I think, lessens the quality of their analysis. But if you are able to, find these types of issues and weave them into your campaign, you're spending too much on R&D, you double down on fossil fuels, that's, not only bad for the environment, but I think it's also a bad business decision. If you're able to integrate that, and obviously for environmental, it's easy to do in more energy and industrial type of companies, I think those are the campaigns where you'll see these ENS issues interwoven and activists or do a better job and get some take up from the voters. It's also seen on the social side, right? So it's social and human capital management and tying that to a company's culture and weaving that all together into board oversight. So you can see if an activist can weave these issues into their core thesis, they're going to be much more successful and get a lot more receptivity from investors when they do so.
Well, one of the takeaways that I have from that case is if you're able to convince BlackRock, Fidelity, and Vanguard, the big voters, plus the proxy advisors, Glass Lewis and ISS, you probably have already, you know, 50% of the vote, and you're almost there. So it's really interesting how these votes come down to few players, right? And that's it's a big game there.
It is fascinating, and it's really a few individuals. So if you take BlackRock, Vanguard, mm-hmm. sometimes State Street, mm-hmm. ISS, maybe one of the institutions like a Fidelity or a Capital or a T. Rowe, you have five or six people, individual person ultimately making a decision that controls 60% of the vote. And if you take out on one side, you take out insider ownership, which is obviously going to vote for the company, and you take out activist ownership and hedge fund ownership, which is going to support the activist, you have 80% of the shares left, and 50% are these five institutions that are going to be the swing vote. So it really is the case when I look at shareholder bases for the vast majority of the companies that I look at, the swing vote is going to be this group of a handful of people at these major institutions that are making the decision.
Yeah, no, John Coates from Harvard Law School has a good paper on this. The argument is that very few people are going to command a lot of the power over corporations. And, I suppose there is a potential antitrust issue down the line, right? That's a different question. But it's fascinating from, your side of things on who makes and who votes and how these institutions have become pivotal, and it goes back to ESG, right? Like they pushed a lot of ESG sustainability in the agenda of corporations. And now we're seeing a pushback from the conservative side and saying, Florida is going to take away BlackRock and all these institutions, and it's become very polarized. And I think ESG maybe in the last 6 months has been politicized as never before. And it's fascinating where we're going in this discussion.
Yeah, that is definitely the case. And I will say within the world of activism, within the world of contested M&A, I do think that for the most part, these institutions are trying to vote in the manner that they believe enhances long-term value for stockholders. So I do think while ENS and G are parts of their analysis, they really do try, in these specific situations, try to think about what is the best for stockholders and long-term value from an economic perspective. So they're trying to evaluate the activists' economic thesis, as opposed to, I think, and we're talking more about the 14a8 shareholder proposals mm-hmm. and other, other parts of the voting and governance complex, where I think it's much more purely an ENS policy type decision and influencing companies in that realm. I think activism is it's a factor, but there are many other factors that lead to the voting decisions in these situations.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. The market, we are going through a down cycle. It's really interesting because a lot of the companies have lost significant market cap. Obviously, that's spread into the private markets too. But how does this impact, where companies have lost 20, 30, 50, 60, 70% of market cap, how does it impact activism? And do you see more of these activists trying to pounce at these lower valuations?
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm often asked what the various aspects of the market cycle impact activism. And I have to say it really impacts the mix. And maybe there's some variability a little bit in terms of the amount, but it's the type of activism. So I think that only two situations or cases where I've seen activism really fall off a cliff were the financial crisis, where you actually did have half the hedge funds blow up and not exist anymore. So you did have a more prolonged period without shareholder activism or with a depressed level. And then the 2 months or 3 months post-COVID. Other than that, it's really just a question of what is the mix and how does it evolve? And you saw it here in the last couple of months, and you put your finger on it, that there are some subsectors of the market which are down 50, 60%. And the one that was hit hardest or among the hardest is within technology, internet software companies, the darlings of COVID, right? Mm-hmm. The ones that really ramped up in the summer in 2020, because they were all in line with this virtual, you know, living situation that we find ourselves in, have all come back substantially. And if you look at the first half and where the most campaigns were in the sector and in industry, it was technology and internet and software. And so you are seeing a lot of activists come in and taking advantage of the market downturn. And frankly, this is the time where activists, from a tactical perspective, it's least advantageous. Right after the nomination notice has, a deadline has expired, right after the annual meeting, gives the activists the least amount of leverage from a proxy contest perspective. But the valuations are just so compelling at these levels that you are seeing a lot of activists rush in to the places that are depressed. And we're using this, you know, this industry as an example. There are others, but you're seeing activists really shift their focus and trying to take advantage of the market downturn in those places where they think there are very compelling valuations.
Since we are in Silicon Valley, you know, one of the arguments historically that, let's say, venture capital investors had is, look, you got to stay private for longer. And if you can raise capital in private markets, you don't have to go public and deal with activists or deal with short sellers or deal with the SEC or higher transparency. Just stay here. In the pandemic, something interesting happened. A lot of these companies actually went public, and we had the record number of IPOs, SPACs, and all this activity, although this year it's dry, right? But the question I have for you is, one of the arguments and one of the elements of what happened in private markets is that terms became much more founder-friendly, and investors were in a position that, look, they are looking for the biggest and most valuable companies. There's the power law distribution. And some of the terms, such as dual clause share structures, became prominent. You know, at least in Silicon Valley, since Google's IPO in 2004, a lot of the tech companies decided to use dual clause share structures, in part to say, look, the decision of the company should be in the founder and not in the investors or, you know, maybe activists or others. And that became a big issue, right? Particularly after Snapchat went public, where they had a triple clause share structure where the shares were non-voting stock. So my question to you is, you know, what do you think, as, you know, in the market when you have activism and they target tech companies that have dual clause share structures, and how does that play out? Is that an effective defense? And what is the battleground in those types of companies?
Yeah, I think it is a very strong defense. So if you're a controlled company, and that can be with dual class shares, or it could be because the founder owns 60% of the company in a single class structure, that is a very strong defense. You take the proxy contest, you take the voting tool as a hammer away from the activist. Now, that doesn't mean you're immune. There are many companies that have been attacked as controlled companies, and I can think of a couple of over the last couple of weeks where that hit the headlines, which are, you know, essentially controlled companies with 40, 50, 60% owned by insiders, venture capitalists, and founders that still find themselves the subject of activists. And I do think, and this is one thing that I think independent directors do a very good job at, and most companies, in my experience, when you have a controlled company, but you have truly independent directors, high quality directors that are on other companies' boards, they do behave independently, and they are conscious of their perception of themselves and of the company when they are inside a controlled company, and they are guarding those. And so they act in a way that benefits the you know, the shareholders writ large, and are very, very conscious of their duties in that regard. So I've seen that in many companies, not all, but in many companies, where that really is a very, you know, strong voice for the other shareholders in the boardroom when you do face one of these challenges, whether it's activist, whether it's potential acquisition. I guess when I was law school, I was more skeptical of that. And having seen it play out, I really do think that is a important part of the governance function when you do have a dual class structure.
Well, one of the interesting things there is that I always say that even if you have dual clause shares and let's say it's 20-1 voting and maybe you don't have any sunset provision, but your stock is down 80-90%, that's no defense, because it's not a good place to be as a CEO, right? Because the underperformance is clear, whether personal or because of your management or because of market, but that's where activists are going to come in. And I think That has been clear in some of these cases earlier this year, where it's a little bit the case of activists when they publish this white paper and they show like, that's what's going on. And it's interesting because people tend to think that dual clause share structures are a complete defense, but it's not really.
It's not. It takes, I mean, the proxy contest is the ultimate tool for an activist, right? It is the hammer to be able to change the board. So you do take that away, but it does not mean that you are fully insulated. So we see plenty of activism at controlled companies, and I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
So we've talked a lot about the proxy contest, but there's a lot of hostile M&A as well. So you are also involved in contested M&A situations. Obviously, we're going through the biggest of them with Twitter and Elon Musk, which is going to be really interesting to see the trial happening in October. Where are we in terms of contested M&A versus proxy contest?
Yeah, we really saw a lot of contested M&A coming out of COVID. So in the fall of 2020, when you had companies that were strategically attractive assets down 60%. We had one situation where we had, as an industrial company, had four different letters from strategics that had always wanted to buy the company, and now was the opportunity, and then ended up getting sold, 100% plus premium, right? I mean, it was just a really mad dash when you came out of COVID. I think you're seeing, we'll see how this downturn plays out in terms of the level of hostile M&A. But I think the one thing that's important, and it's a synergy, as you might call it, between, some might call it an unholy alliance, but between shareholder activists and hostile acquirers, is a lot of times these days, shareholder activists will do the dirty work, right? If there is a leak in the press that there's strategic interest or this company is, potentially for sale, you'll see an activist step in, and the activist will carry all the water for the hostile bidder. It's tough to be a hostile bidder, right? If you are the one that's out there publicly hostile against the company, automatically you're at the bottom of the preferred bidder list, right? You're actively fighting management. So that's not a good place to be if you want to own the company. Having an activist come in and really try to bang the drums, try to force a process, be public, that's happening more and more. And so you will see quote unquote hostile M&A, where you have the hostile bidder being the one that is out front, less so because activists are willing to carry that flag.
Yeah. And what's interesting here is how maybe the Elon case has highlighted the role of the board and poison pills and what should the board do in these situations like never before, maybe, right?
Yeah, I think there are some individuals in this environment where it's tough to generalized trends. Carl Icahn's one of them. Elon Musk is another, right? It's these are unusual circumstances, and every activist situation is unique in its own way. But these are very, very unusual situations where it's tough to generalize.
Yeah, no, I agree. Elon is one of a kind. So one of the big changes coming up in the industry is the adoption of universal proxy. And that's coming up in August of this year. Maybe why don't you explain what's going on? What is this rule change from the SEC, and how is that going to impact the activist landscape?
Sure. Yeah. So it used to be the case, and it's the case for the next 33 days, where if there's an annual meeting that is contested, each of the dissidents, in simplified terms, each of the activists and the company have their own voting ballot. And they're not the same. They don't have the same people on it. And so if you're an investor and you want to choose who to vote for, the first decision you have to make is, whose ballot do I vote on? And there's some overlap between the two ballots, but they're not exactly the same. So the first decision you have to make is, whose ballot do I vote on? And then you only get to vote in those ballot for all practical purposes. And so there's really a two-step decision that exists now. Do I support the company or the activist, generally speaking, and then who within that do I support? That is changing, and that is changing, and the universal proxy is exactly what it says. So it'll be a single ballot with everybody on it, all of the candidates, whether they're nominated by the company or nominated by the dissident. And I think that has a really, really can have a significant impact in the way that activism evolves. It is generally perceived, and I strongly believe, in most cases, it favors the activist. Not in all, but in most cases, it favors the activist. And I think there's been a lot of debate about this, more than I thought there'd be. But I think that you don't really have to understand more than the fact that Sidley is the number one defender of companies and shareholder activism. And we wrote a letter to the SEC. I think we're the only law firm arguing against the universal proxy, and our counterparts who have top share as on the activist side wrote a letter supporting the universal proxy, right? So I think it's pretty clear that in the vast majority of cases, or at least the majority of cases, this change is favorable to activists. When we'll see how it unfolds, I do think that this, at the very least, is going to introduce a lot of uncertainty about outcomes. And when you have uncertainty about outcomes, it's going to lead to more settlements. Because the last thing a company wants to do is, let's go through all of the brain damage, all of the distraction at a time where we don't need it, to have a proxy contest where we have tremendous uncertainty about where we're going to end up after we go through it. And so I think people had been comfortable with the system before and understood the, you know, their risks and their chances of success. At least for the next couple of years, there'll be more uncertainty. And I do think, since it favors activists, you will see settlements migrate towards the activist side. I've heard of several activists that have talked about putting forth larger slates, in order to gain leverage in negotiations. And so I think there is a risk that you do have settlements that favor activists more than they have in the past. I think there's also a possibility that you have more of the, you know, gadfly governance types that use the universal proxy. And I know of at least one of them that was arguing that proxy access was a failure. It did nothing for governance, and hopefully universal proxy will be our savior, right? So there is at least discussion within that world of potentially using the universal proxy and the lower costs of running a contest that it entails to achieve what are more traditionally, you know, governance or ENS goals very directly, kind of similar to the way that the 14A8 shareholder proposal process works. So we'll see. I think the only guarantee over the next year or two is uncertainty as we figure out how this will shape the landscape. But there's a number of ways this can proceed. And from my perspective, I'm concerned about several of them.
What is, by the way, you mentioned the shareholder proposal season. What is your takeaway from that outcome, and as it spills over into activism? Maybe the ENS has been more prominent, and the pushback from some of the large institutional investors can show something into activism. But any takeaways from the shareholder proposal season?
I think they're distinct. I do think that they're distinct with respect to shareholder proposals. Now, certainly you have an SEC that is committed to fostering more shareholder proposals through multiple rule changes and interpretation changes. And so you are seeing more and more of these shareholder proposals being put forth, and that'll be even more true next season. There is a limit, though, and there is a point at which the shareholders will say, that's going a little bit too far. And I think you saw that in this season a bit. When you have environmental proposals relating to increased disclosure, those are generally, in this day and age, at least in, you know, the past year or two, fairly well received in industries where it's relevant. When you're trying to dictate substantive actions a company should take through the 14A8 process, that's probably not what the process was intended. And I think you are seeing some shareholders push back and say, you know, wait a second, it's one thing to get the disclosure out there. It's another thing to dictate exactly what a company should do. We are not the best situated, and we don't have all the information to take right. The right actions. That's what we have a board of directors for. So you are seeing some on the proponent side, I think, going a little bit too far in what they're proposing. But there will be more and more of these proposals that companies have to deal with going forward.
Yeah. And finally, on these governance questions, what are your takeaways for directors of companies based on shareholder activism? And what do you think are the important takeaways for them from this season?
Yeah, I think the most important thing is the universal proxy and what that will do for shareholder activism. It'll put much more focus on individual skill sets. It'll put focus on how those skill sets fit within the board writ large and how they complement one another. As you're going to have on a single ballot, activist nominees and company nominees, and you're going to have a lot of shareholders that are looking at the skill sets and trying to think about what would be the optimal board. And if the activist is putting forth credible directors with skill sets that are missing that are related to something, a strategy the company is pursuing, or a strategy that the activist is advocating that shareholders agree with, it's going to become much more important. So I think the biggest lesson takeaway from this season for directors are those on NomGov, especially the chair of NomGov, how they think about board refreshment, how they think about putting the director slates together, and really thinking about, you know, we've had this term for the last 8 years, be your own activist, you know, thinking about your company from an activist perspective. I think that it's expanded now. Now you have to think about if not only the economic theses, what the activists would change, but what are the types of people they would put up? And are those types of people you should have on your board? And so I think it is really expanded to NomGov in a way that was a step function difference versus before universal proxy. And I you know, directors that are on that committee really should pay attention and think about the way that they're doing things.
Yeah, you made me think of one topic, which is in board composition. A lot has been said about diversity in both gender and race. Has this played out in the activist realm as well, or some companies putting forward nominees that are diverse, and or is it kind of business as usual?
No, it is certainly changed the way companies behave. I think last I saw the proportion of women as new directors was above 50%.
Yeah,
And activists are, you know, a little slower on the uptake, and it's also the case that the people that are in their stable of candidates historically are white men, and that takes time to change. And so that the last that I saw that the activists were putting up 20% were diverse, which is a lot different than it was, you know, several years ago. So I think they are both migrating in the direction of more diversity. It's just the activist nominees are a little, you know, a little slower in terms of the percentage that are diverse.
Interesting. All right. Well, let's move into the rapid fire questions. What are the 1, 2, 3 books that have greatly influenced your life?
Wow, greatly influenced. It sounds so so profound. Yeah, I think one book that is relevant here that really did influence my philosophy and the way, you know, my outlook is a book called Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman, by the famed physicist Richard Feynman, where, you know, I read it and he just had such a mastery of the topic and a way of explaining it that was so clear and simple that you read it and you think, I am so dumb for not realizing this, because the solution is so obvious. Now that he says it, obviously that's the way that the world works. And so his ability to take complex, you know, a complex system, complex ideas, and really explain them in a way that was very understandable was what had a big impact on me. And I feel like as a, you know, my expertise is an inch or two wide and a mile deep, I feel like I'm often in that role. And so this book and, you know, the way that he approached explaining things is often in the forefront of mine when I'm trying to convey things to a board of directors who hasn't been through this before.
Right. No, that's a really good one. Any other book?
That's probably the one that okay. resonates the most. I think there's a number that are, there's a number of others, but that's the one I think is most relevant.
All right. Are there any quotes that you think of often or live your life by?
Yeah, one is a Beatles song. Think for yourself. Which I think is, you know, in our family, my wife is a MD PhD professor at Stanford. So we have a you know, critical thinking and, you know, having opinion based on evidence and facts, especially to give my background, is a very important value in our family. And I think it's also relevant to, you know, to what I do here. You know, activism defense has a playbook, right? There is a playbook for activism defense, and the playbook is well-worn because in most situations, the playbook works. But the trick in activism defense is, you know, every single situation, there's 15% to 30% of actions where you need to critically think about it and go off playbook and do something different. And the trick to being good at this job is really understanding which situations which decisions you really need to do something different and be creative. And that's, I think, a big part of, you know, what I do is how I think about the, you know, these different situations and where do you have to think for yourself and do something that's a bit unexpected and creative.
Mm-hmm. So I missed the quote. What was it?
Think for yourself.
That's okay. The title. All right, great. What is an unusual habit or an absurd thing that you love?
Yeah, so my kids are, you know, 4 and 6, so we watch a lot of small clips, 5-minute clips on various topics, and I will tell you, I have been fascinated by all things space related, astrophysics related, and it's probably something that's been around a long time. And my father-in-law worked for NASA, and so we get regaled by amazing stories from the 60s and 70s. But it really is, you know, these are 5-minute clips built for young kids that I am sitting there fascinated by. And I think that one thing that sprang out of that is my favorite animal, which is called a tardigrade. A tardigrade is a very, very small animal that can withstand just extreme conditions. It can extreme, you know, radiation, space, you know, live a long time and goes into this hibernation state. There's at least one group that has alleged to have put a tardigrade close to absolute zero and put them then in a quantum entangled state. So it's just a fascinating to me that you have this little animal that can just exist through these extreme conditions in a way that's, you know, unfathomable for any of the rest of us that exist.
I thought cockroaches were the ones that had that reputation.
I did too. And then I didn't know what a tardigrade was. And then I learned about it. I'm like, that is just super fascinating that this thing exists.
I love it. Finally, which living person do you most admire?
Most admire. So you have these very weighty ways of phrasing this. I'll say the one that I do admire most is a big word, is I would say Nate Silver. And I say Nate Silver because he's representative of somebody that really uses information and evidence and data to help guide decision making. And he's kind of on the forefront of that. And we're in a society now where we have very, very divergent opinions and can't even agree that we're going to use reality and evidence and data as the decision making criteria, which will get us to the right answer. And so we've moved very far away from this concept. And my hope is, and my belief is, and my philosophy is that hopefully we will move back towards that. So at least we can, you know, agree wherever the data leads, wherever the evidence leads, it leads. But let's have an objective sense of reality and where things are in order to make these types of decisions.
Yeah, that's great. And it just makes me think that maybe your kids will get to space, right? They will get to Mars or the moon, right? That's good likelihood.
So. Maybe so. We already talked about one person whose dream is to go to Mars and die on Mars, but not on impact.
Yeah, I think that was a good one. Derek, thank you so much for talking to me, taking the time to doing this. This was great. Activism is a really important topic on corporate governance, and we'll see how the evolution with universal proxy goes up. But certainly, we're going to see more of this. So it's great to get your views. And hopefully we'll get to meet soon.
Yeah, no, thanks a lot, Evan. I had a great time.
Thank you for tuning in to the Boardroom Governance Podcast. If you like what you heard, please consider subscribing, leaving a review, or sharing this podcast on social media. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can just find me on LinkedIn or Twitter at Evan Epstein. You can also check out all the details related to this podcast on the website boardroom-governance.com, and please feel free to subscribe to the Boardroom Governance newsletter at evanepstein.substack.com.